Indiscriminate attacks tops 33,600. The UK government comes under fire from human rights groups for refusing to end its arms sales to Israel amid ongoing genocide in Gaza. And in Australia, authorities say several people have been killed as a man armed with a knife attacked shoppers at a busy mall in Sydney. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. Israeli military's unrelenting attacks on Gaza continue to claim more civilian lives. At least 29 people were killed when a home in central Gaza city was hit. Another 20 people lost their lives in other Israeli strikes throughout other areas of the coastal sliver. Israeli forces also targeted a number of journalists in the Nuseirat refugee camp in central Gaza, causing casualties. According to medical sources, one of the journalists is also in critical condition. More than 33,600 people have so far been killed in Gaza since Israel launched its genocidal campaign on October the 7th. Thousands are still missing. A Geneva-based human rights organization has estimated over 13,000 Gazans are unaccounted for. The Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor says many of those missing are either buried under rubble or in indiscriminate mass graves. And joining us earlier for an update from the besieged enclave is our Gaza correspondent, Muti Abu Musab.
In the meantime, when it comes to Khan Yunis city, as you know, that the medical staff and the civil defense crews still this moment are working on extracting more dead bodies and corpses, which were left behind the massive destruction inflicted by the Israeli occupation forces in that area over the last 24 hours. 10 Palestinian dead bodies were extracted from the rubble of those destroyed houses, particularly in Al-Amal neighborhood located in the western part of Khan Yunis city. So the current situation is still tense across all areas of Gaza Strip, basically here in the central area of Gaza Strip and Nusayrat refugee camp, where the Israeli military operation is still underway with more relentless attacks against that area. What happened in Khan Yunis is horrific because, as you know, that for roughly 4 consecutive months and the Israeli occupation forces have been attacking and were attacking that area, including the aerial, the land, and even the sea attacks from the sea. The entire residential buildings were destroyed. We are talking about entire residential squares that were wiped out of the map. Percent of the house units and the constructions and the buildings in Khan Yunis city were completely or partially destroyed, knowing that Khan Yunis was the second largest city in Gaza Strip. So now Khan Yunis was literally reduced to be the city of rubble. Wherever you turn your eyes in Khan Yunis city, you would observe and see the rubble and the mounds of debris left behind those constant and chronic attacks that were hitting that area. What happened in Khan Yunis is indescribable, unbelievable, because everything was reached by the Israeli occupation forces on the ground or by the Israeli warplanes was destroyed completely, including the infrastructure, the streets, the residential buildings, the health facilities. Everything was destroyed. Khan Yunis was completely reduced to be an unlivable place.
The military wing of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement has carried out fresh retaliatory attacks on several Israeli cities and settlements in occupied territories. The Al-Quds brigades targeted the city of Sadarat and several settlements surrounding Gaza with multiple rockets. There's been no report of damage or fatalities yet. The Islamic Jihad movement said attacks are in response to Israeli regime's crimes against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The Al-Quds brigades also managed to capture an Israeli Skylark drone in Gaza's southern city of Khan Yunis. Palestinian resistance fighters from different groups have carried out numerous attacks against Israeli positions in retaliation for the Gaza genocide. They've also been putting stiff resistance to Israeli ground forces in Gaza. An explosive device has ripped through a car in the Syrian capital, Damascus, but reportedly has caused no casualties. According to Syrian media, blasts occurred in an upscale neighborhood where several foreign diplomatic missions are located. Details are still sketchy at this time, and There's really been no claim of responsibility, and it's still not immediately clear who's targeted in this explosion. Security incidents, including blasts targeting military or civilian vehicles, happen intermittently in Damascus. Now, welcome everyone to News Review Program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Reactions continue pouring in after the British government said it will not suspend arms exports to Israel. A now UK-based organization called the Campaign Against Arms Trade says London is complicit in the regime's war crimes in Gaza.
David Cameron's announcement that the UK will continue arming Israel is outrageous and illegal given the mounting and indisputable evidence that Israel is committing war crimes amounting to genocide. Rishi Sunak, David Cameron, and the rest of the government alongside the UK arms trade are complicit in these war crimes, and they should face the consequences of this complicity.
The Campaign Against Arms Trade also said that the UK government treats Palestinian lives with utter contempt and is only seeking to serve the interests of its arms dealers. It's also called on British citizens to continue keeping up pressure on the government, as well as the Labour Party, to totally ban weapon sales to Israel. Meanwhile, UK-based charity Oxfam says London's decision is illegal and immoral.
It's illegal, immoral, and inconsistent for the UK to continue to sell arms to Israel when it is clear that UK-made weapons and components are being used in serious violation of international humanitarian law.
Shivji also called on UK authorities to work toward an immediate ceasefire in the Gaza Strip and use its power to ensure aid delivery to the besieged territory. The British Foreign Minister announced on Tuesday that London's position on arms sales to Israel will remain unchanged. David Cameron said the government will not block arms exports to Israel by British companies. This after over 600 British legal experts, including judges and lawyers, signed a letter calling on the government to halt all arms sales to the Israeli regime. Britain supplied over $15 million of arms to Israel in 2022 alone. Joining us now for our program is Harley Schlanger, spokesman for International Schiller Institute out of Potsdam, Germany, and Barry Grossman, international lawyer, joining us out of Bali, Indonesia. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess we'll start there with you, Mr. Harley Schlanger. Nice to have you on the program, sir. Now, Britain, people of the British society, whether it's from the public realm, private, obviously many political voices, they're not supporting their government's complicity in this campaign of genocide in Israel. So why is Rishi Sunak's government not listening?
Well, thank you for your invitation. Let me start by saying that there's no question that the Western response to the developments in Gaza and also the attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus is an example of murderous hypocrisy. And most of the world sees this. The idea that Biden is calling on Tehran to show restraint, that Sunak is saying the threat of Iran to retaliate is completely unacceptable. The idea that the British are ignoring their own laws and international law by continuing to send weapons and funding to Israel is proof that these governments, especially the UK and the United States, are complicit in war crimes. And most of the world sees that. Now, the question is how to deal with that. And I think that there are two aspects to this. One, you need a much stronger outcry from people in the UK and the United States. More demonstrations, more newspaper ads, more pressure on political officials. But secondly, the need for the Global South to step up more, which includes measures that could include boycotts of Israel, could include cuts of any relations with Israel. And I think we're seeing the direction that that's going. The most important point is that there's no excuse for genocide. And the fact that the United States and the UK are continuing to be complicit by providing weapons and money, and more importantly, political cover is a disgrace, and it should lead to either the change in policy in those countries or a complete isolation of the United States and the UK.
All right, thank you for your initial thoughts there, Mr. Harley Schlanger. Joining us now from Bali, Indonesia, is also international lawyer Barry Grossman. Barry, pleasure to check in with you again. Now, Barry, the U.S., its support for the Israeli regime when it comes to weapons is around 70%. It's followed by the Germans. They're around about 24%. You got about 5.5-6% coming from Italy. So when it comes to Canada and the U.K., they're at a measly 1%. I mean, these are losses they can cut and walk away from and not further expose themselves to being part of this war criminal campaign of genocide. Why don't they?
Well, it's a very good question, and I think, as always, is a very high level of concern amongst the political apparatus that any change in policy, any moves at the expense of the occupation will lead to repercussions which are very severe in the global economy and elsewhere. So there's a great reluctance, and of course I'd like to say that the position taken by the UK is somehow surprising, but of course it's not. It was only a few years ago that the Conservative government in the UK made it perfectly clear in the case of Bahrain that it would continue to sell arms, provide arms to the regime in Bahrain, regardless of what those arms were used for. And as a matter of policy, from the highest levels of the Prime Minister, it was stated that the UK would not draw a link between any nation's human rights record and the sale of arms. So we come to the status quo, and the status quo is we're still fighting to have it recognized at the appropriate court, the ICJ, that there is a genocide unfolding. It's very obvious to many of us, but it's not apparently all that obvious to those nations that traditionally support the occupation. And that being the case, for example, with the Nicaraguan case against Germany, there's some major obstacles to overcome. And this idea of complicity or facilitation, even though it's expressly declared to be prosecutable as an offense in the appropriate treaty on genocide, there's not a lot of jurisprudence about where it starts and where it ends. For example, it's far from clear that we can get away without establishing first that a genocide has taken place. Secondly, there's a question about what mental element has to be established on the part of countries which are to be prosecuted for facilitation. That is, do they have to intend that weapons supplied are used for genocide or crimes against humanity or war crimes before they can be prosecuted? Or is it enough that a reasonable person looking at what's unfolding would draw that conclusion? These are all very difficult, complicated questions, and I don't think we're going to see any answers quickly, certainly not until the major case brought by South Africa and supported by others against Israel plays out to a final judgment. It's very clear to anybody with a conscience, to anyone who embraces a moral view of the world, that the occupation is engaging in horrendous war crimes against Palestinians. But of course, the United States and the United Kingdom and some other lesser light countries would argue the point, and that's where we're at right now. So it's very difficult in that legal milieu, that legal environment, to try and commence proceedings against countries like the UK and Germany and expect any level of success in establishing that they're somehow facilitating a genocide which has not yet been proven to the satisfaction of the ICJ to have been committed. So very difficult circumstances. But of course, there's a number of ways of looking at this. One is, of course, the legal way. The other is the moral way. And the people of these countries and people around the world have no difficulty, unlike their political leaders, in forming the view that the position taken by Israel, by the United States, by the United Kingdom and Germany, morally speaking, if not legally, is absolutely woeful, and for that reason alone need to rethink and change their policy before we even get to the question of legal accountability. But sadly, nobody seems to be willing to do that, as much out of fear as anything else, I would suggest.
All right, gentlemen, thank you both for joining us on the program. Time has gotten the better of us. Stay safe to both of you. Mr. Hardy Schlinger, their spokesman for International Schiller Institute, joining us out of Potsdam, Germany, and Mr. Barry Grossman, international lawyer, joining us out of Bali, Indonesia. This brings us to the conclusion of this segment of your news review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
People across Africa marked the International Coast Day with massive rallies to demonstrate solidarity with the oppressed people of Palestine while condemning the Israeli apartheid regime over its atrocities and occupation of Palestine. Record numbers turned out at this year's rallies because the world has been awoken by the horrific genocidal crimes being perpetrated against Palestinians by the Israeli apartheid regime in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. South Africa's case at the International Court of Justice over the Israeli apartheid regime's genocidal war on Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip has galvanized African support for Palestine. The large turnout at this year's Quds Day rallies across Africa once again reaffirmed the continent's historical support for the liberation of Palestine. Now, elsewhere in Africa, Senegal witnessed a historical presidential election in which Bassirou Diomaye Faye won by a landslide, thus becoming Senegal's youngest president. So, what will be the future of Senegal under the new leadership? Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and this is Africa Today. This week, we're focusing on International Coast Day rallies in Africa that demonstrated Africa's unflinching solidarity with oppressed Palestinians and condemnation of the Israeli apartheid regime and its crimes. Now, the second segment of our program will be on the recent presidential election in Senegal. So, stay tuned with us.
Coast Day in Africa.
The last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan marks International Quds Day, a day dedicated to showing solidarity with the Palestinian people and their struggle against Israeli occupation. This annual event was first initiated by the late Imam Khomeini, founder of the Islamic Republic, in 1979 as a way to raise awareness about the plight of Palestinians and to call for the liberation of Quds.
Since then, events marking Quds Day have been held in African countries. Now this year, the masses in Africa, angered by the US-Israeli genocide on Palestinians in Gaza, turned out in large numbers at various events marking the International Quds Day. Here are some of the images.
Free, free Palestine!
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 1, 2, 3, 4!
Now to discuss this year's Quds Day rallies in Africa, we have contacted Dr. Wahida Qasim. She's the daughter of the late Imam Ahmed Qasim, the founder and leader of the Qibla movement in South Africa. Dr. Qasim is a member of the leadership committee of this movement. Thanks a lot for your time, madam, today.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Brother Mubarak, shukran for having me.
Now, our first question to Dr. Qasim. Tell us the significance of the International Quds Day in Africa this year, particularly considering the ongoing U.S.-Israeli genocide on Palestinians in Gaza.
The International Quds Day, the call for solidarity with and in support of the oppressed masses the world over, especially that of the Palestinian people, has always been of significance to the justice and freedom-loving people of Africa. The Qibla movement, since its establishment in 1980, has since then, and shortly after the call by Imam Khomeini, may Allah be pleased with him, the call which was for the solidarity of the masses with the oppressed people, has been hosting the Quds Day March in Cape Town, and that is for approximately now 42 years. This year, however, it is more significant because of the heinous, calculated massacring of our Palestinian brethren and the fact that the South African government has taken this matter to the ICJ, the International Court of Justice.
African people have brutally experienced firsthand mankind's disregard for human life during the evil transatlantic slave trade and later when colonial powers ruled with an iron fist over the continent. With such a historical background, African people can relate with suffering of Palestinian people.
The liberation of all oppressed people is and will be important for the people of Africa. Africa itself being a colonized continent has been actively shedding its colonizers' hold. The colonizers are using the resources of Africa to fund the genocide in occupied Palestine. We have an example of three of our African countries, namely Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso, who have recently liberated themselves from the French neocolonial stronghold. So the liberation of Palestine is therefore of utmost importance to Africa.
The Quds Day rallies across the world convey various messages, chief among them being hatred towards the genocidal Zionist regime, as well as support for the oppressed nation of Palestine.
If you remember very well, the Palestinians, when we were under apartheid, they said, let us liberate the South Africans. Later, when South Africans are liberated, they will come and liberate us. So what I'm saying is that there was an international pressure. There were organizations such as this which placed the pressure upon the oppressors who oppressed us at the time.
This is a man-made situation, so it's a humanitarian issue. However, it's been man-made by Israel. All they need to do is open up the borders and then people can start eating and living again.
And now my next question to Dr. Wahida Qasim. Now, what was the main message of the International Quds Day in Africa this year?
In South Africa, we have a saying. We say, neither oppressor nor oppressed be. By this we mean that the days of the oppressors have been numbered. And by the same token, the oppressed masses are craving their liberation, as I'm sure the Palestinian people are too. The oppressor, we say, will not dictate to the oppressed on how to respond to their oppression, nor will the oppressor dictate the terms of engagement.
Now, African states are emerging today as strong supporters of the Palestinian cause, and the South African case against the Israeli regime at the ICJ is a case in point.
We have seen how the current genocidal war against Palestinians has isolated the Zionist regime in Africa, and this year's Quds Day rallies have left no doubt that African masses are with the oppressed Palestinians. Many in Africa are now demanding that their governments take a more affirmative position in favor of Palestinians.
We would want all other African countries also to liberate themselves, as was done by our three African countries, namely Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali. And the same direction is now being taken by Senegal. It is the responsibility of the citizens to apply pressure on their governments, their respective governments, who are to serve the interests of their citizens and not their puppeteers, to ensure that they will follow through on these demands.
The apartheid regime in South Africa was ousted partly due to the successful international boycott movement. Some African countries, particularly South Africa, are implementing initiatives to boycott this brutal Israeli apartheid regime, particularly during the ongoing genocide in Gaza. Now, my next question to Dr. Wahida Kasim. How successful is the current movement to boycott the Israeli regime, and what should be done to actually strengthen it?
A common slogan that is chanted by our South African people is a slogan that goes as follows: brick by brick, wall by wall, the Zionist state will fall. This means to us that by any means necessary, utilizing all forms of resistance, including the boycotting campaign, that we will continue to chip away at the Zionist state's existence. We must intensify all our efforts of resistance to ensure the liberation of the Palestinian people, but also of the oppressed people the world over.
Nelson Mandela famously said that our freedom is incomplete without the freedom of the Palestinians. The International Quds Day is always a great reminder of Mandela's resolve to back the liberation of Palestine.
And now my last question. Dr. Kasim, what needs to be done by the people of Africa to ensure that Nelson Mandela's aspiration for a free Palestine is eventually attained?
The unity of the African masses is of paramount importance, as according to Hadith, which states that the Ummah is like a body. And if one part of the body is afflicted, the rest of the body will feel or respond to that affliction. So yes, unless all the oppressed people are liberated, will we ourselves not be free? Because until then, we have the obligation and the responsibility to support and engage in the oppressed people's fight for liberation. I do want to add that the Qibla movement has always maintained the following principle: that we are non-violent to non-violent people only. When others resort to violence, they make nonsense of our non-violence. And unless our legitimate right to the freedom of expression and association and self-determination is protected by the legitimate right to self-defense and resistance, then all of our other rights are going to be violated and rendered useless and impotent. So first, we call for the unification of all the African countries and its people, so that we can secure the liberation of all the oppressed people in Africa, as well as those across the world.
Well, unfortunately, our time is over for now. I would like to thank Dr. Wahida Qasim for her insight on the International Coups Day in Africa. We now take a short break before our next topic on the recent presidential election in Senegal. Stay with us.
Victory for Senegalese democracy.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Bassirou Diomaye Faye, a Pan-Africanist, has been sworn in as Senegal's youngest president, pledging systematic change, greater sovereignty, and calm after years of deadly turmoil.
Senegal's youngest president, Faye, defeated the ruling coalition's candidate in a March election by a landslide, reflecting high hopes for change in the country of around 18 million.
Addressing the Senegalese nation after his victory, Faye, a popular politician among disaffected youth, promised to govern with humility and transparency.
The Senegalese people have chosen to break with the past, to give substance to the immense hopes raised by our vision of society. I hope that our vision of society has given substance to their aspirations. I pledge to govern with humility and transparency, and to fight corruption at all levels.
Well, for more on Senegal's historic presidential election, we have contacted Galissa Bouly, Secretary General of the African Patriots of Senegal for Work, Ethics and Fraternity branch in the west coast of the U.S. This is the political party of the newly elected President Diomaye Faye and Prime Minister Ousmane Sonko. Thank you for your time, sir, today.
It's a pleasure being with you, Mubarak.
Now, Faye won more than 54% of the votes cast in Senegal's delayed presidential election. He was released from prison 10 days before the election, and therefore he did not have even ample time to campaign. Now, briefly, can you tell us what are the main factors behind this historic and significant victory of Mr. Faye?
It's because the Senegalese people, for the last 12 years, have been betrayed by Macky Sall leadership. But also, from independence to now, the Senegalese people are trying to find a leader that will lead this country in the benefit of the population of this country. So I think this victory is the victory of the people, is the victory of freedom, but it's the victory of democracy. It's the victory of Senegalese people deciding for the first time to have a leader that would represent their interests.
Over the past few years, we have seen several protests against France in Senegal. Many young people regarded Macky Sall as a symbol of French capitalism. Ousmane Sonko, who is now the Prime Minister of Senegal, won mass support by attacking French imperialism's stranglehold on the nation. He was imprisoned by Sall and even barred from running in the presidential election. There are strong indicators that France is in the suppression and imprisonment of Faye and Sonko.
All I know is that Mr. Sonko and Mr. Diomaye Faye are two Senegalese people that know very well who is investing in Senegal, who has interest in Senegal. And Mr. Ousmane Sonko, for the last 10 years, have been fighting, building awareness about Senegal to have back the economy, to have back the resources that is in this country. So Mr. Sonko is seen as someone as a liberator because Senegalese economy for the last 64 years have been held majorly by the French companies. So I think you can actually see in the last 4 or 5 years when there were protests, you know, French companies were targeted, you know, by the youth. It's because it was about time for French to recheck their partnership they have with Senegal. But also French never condemned, you know, the dictatorship that was built in Senegal, the repression, all the act that Macky Sall in the last 12 years was doing, and before him the other presidents. So they all had some kind of protection, you know, from France. As we speak, France has like military bases, you know, here in Senegal.
President Bassirou Diomaye Faye says he will implement a comprehensive review of oil, gas and mining contracts. He wants to enhance the state's revenue from these ventures. Now, the decision comes despite immediate former President Macky Sall warning that renegotiating existing contracts could have disastrous consequences for Senegal. Speaking after being sworn in as Senegal's fifth president, Faye spoke of change that will come under his leadership.
Je suis conscient que les résultats sortis des urnes expriment un profond désir de changement.
I am aware that the results of the ballot box express a profound desire for systematic change. Through my election, the Senegalese people have committed themselves to building a fair Senegal, a prosperous Senegal, a progressing Africa.
Now, changes or review of oil, gas and mining contracts will definitely set President Faye on a collision course with Western energy and mining multinationals. Mr. Bouly, now, how do you see this unfolding? I mean, the change of or the review of the contracts?
Mr. Mubarak, if we take a look at history, you know, from the 1970s, even before that, in the 1930s, you know, when we had the bigger crisis, you know, United States of America, and later on, you know, Saudi Arabia, all the oil holding companies, you know, I mean countries, it's normal for when we change leadership to review if everything that was signed in the name of the country was done legally or also in the benefit of the people. I don't know if you took a look at this report that was done here about like a 3-4 years ago by I'm not gonna do a publicity for like a major like a news company, but a news channel, you know, based in England, you know, that unfolded a huge scandal of $10 billion, you know, linked with the younger brother of the President Macky Sall. So we're not gonna let all this go. It's actually totally normal. Those are basically part of the huge target of the actual president, the elected president, Mr. Bassirou Diomaye Jahad Faye, that is to review all this contract. That's not normally if also these companies, these major ventures, if they are here for the benefit of the win-win situation, they should not be scared. If everything was done in a good way, and Senegalese people, and also we have reviewed the law like 2 years ago, the resources are said to be for the people. So these resources, if they are for the people, it's totally acceptable. And I think the investors should actually accept to come and sit on the table to review every single contract that was signed in this last year, you know, regarding the Senegalese resources, gas, oil, gold, or everything.
French capitalism still super exploits Senegal and other ex-colonies, including compelling use of the CFA franc currency. He proposes introducing a new currency instead of the CFA franc that is backed by the French Treasury and used in 14 member countries. This move is expected to have regional implications.
This is not a radical move, Mr. Mubarak. This is actually a great historical and it's about time. You know, radicalism is something that, you know, people will put in a concept, you know, that people are like populists. We are not populists. We are very smart people. 2021 and 2022, normally, we were supposed to start like a currency called ECO. It didn't start because French implication with Ivory Coast and Senegal majorly, these are the two countries that influence, you know, the beginning of this currency. If you even look at the franc CFA, it's historically and socially, it doesn't connect with us. It doesn't connect with this old currency, this currency is still called CFA. CFA is the franc of French colonies in Africa. So how can we even continue using a money that linked to colonialism?
Faye is the youngest ever president of this West African nation. Now, many young people in Africa have lost hope due to bad governance and poverty in the continent. The election of Faye has ignited hope in Senegal and indeed across Africa. President Faye says that Senegal will now be a country of hope. Let's take a listen.
Le Sénégal, sous mon magistère, sera un pays d'espérance.
Under my leadership, Senegal will be a country of hope. A country at peace, with an independent justice system and a strengthened democracy. This is my promise, based on the oath I have just taken before God and the nation in your presence.
And now our last question to Galissa. Now, what does the election of Faye mean for Africa, a continent with the youngest population in the world? Now, are we going to see more young leaders emerging in Africa in future?
Yes, I think we are. It's a great message to the continent. It's a great message to the world. As you said, Africa is the youngest continent, and we are even projecting by 2050 that Africa will be the biggest population in the world, and it will be again. That will mean, you know, the youngest, you know, continent and the biggest population. So, if that's the case today, it's to say to the rest of the continent that all the youth that are being held, that are being said that you cannot or you are not capable of leading, that has to end. Today, in Senegal, we have about 65 to 70% of the population that is young, between 18 to 25, and about 75% that are like between 18 to 35, you know, years old. So it's a great message. It's an absolutely incredible, you know, historical time for Senegal and for the continent. And also, it's a moment to liberate all this talent, all this belief that people had, to tell them, no, you can, and go forward. Try to fight for democracy. Try to fight for your political belief and go ahead. Don't listen to people that are saying that you guys are too young, you cannot be president, or you cannot be prime minister, or you cannot be the president of the Congress, the House, the Legislative House. So I think Senegalese people electing the youngest president in the country right now, it's a great message to the youth. It's about time for them to stop taking the road of immigration, to not believing in themselves, to say that, you know, no, there's no hope for me in my country or in my continent. I need to go somewhere else to try to make a better living.
A strong message there to young people across Africa that if they believe in themselves, then they will achieve their dreams inside Africa. I would like to thank our guest there, Galissa Boly, for his incisive analysis on the recent presidential election in Senegal. Well, and that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. From me, Mubarak Kenya, it's goodbye for now.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
This is for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of For a Better Life. Well, once more, this is Asma at your service. And just for the record, just like always, I have to remind you of the very fact that we all are the same. And in here, I just come to share ideas so that we would have a broader horizon. The pursuit of happiness, Islamic ethics for the modern world. The moral and legal obligation to alleviate or end suffering and hardship helps in understanding the importance of happiness in the Islamic outlook. But the alleviation of suffering and hardship is not the same as the achievement of happiness. Even if the most faithful try their utmost to end hardship, suffering, and misery, this does not amount to the realization of happiness. Although God is self-sufficient and described as the giver, happiness is not realized through simple practice, obedience, or some other formalistic, legalistic dynamic. An effective way to begin to understand the Islamic outlook is to ponder the Prophet Muhammad's refrain, "Whoever succeeds in knowing himself will come to know his Lord." One of the consistent themes in the very large literary corpus dealing with the issue of sa'ada or happiness is an inextricable link drawn between knowledge and enlightenment on the one hand and happiness on the other. The more a believer knows about himself, about other people and cultures, and about the world, the more such a believer will be capable of understanding the balance that is necessary in striving for justice with the self and others. Indeed, the struggle to learn and to achieve self-knowledge and knowledge of the other is labeled by the Prophet as the highest and most challenging form of jihad. The Holy Book of Quran describes those who succeed in understanding the balance and in achieving enlightenment as existing in a true state of happiness. They are in a state of harmony and peace with themselves, creation, and God. This is a state of blissful tranquility, equilibrium, and ultimately peace. In this serene and harmonious state, enlightened believers enjoy a special relationship with God. The Quran describes them as people who come to enjoy a complete sense of fulfillment. They trust God and God trusts them. They love God and God loves them. The state of enlightenment and happiness that they enjoy pervades every aspect of their being to the point that the Quran describes their blissful happiness as manifesting on their joyous and luminous faces. They tread the earth with their inner light between the palms of their hands, which most scholars agree is a symbolic reference to attainment of the divine grace of wisdom. The themes of knowledge, enlightenment, balance, peace, and tranquility are central to the Islamic theology of happiness.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. It's all I need. It's all I need. All I need.
Yes, welcome back. You are listening to For a Better Life. Well, sometimes we describe happiness in different ways, like the way I'm going to define happiness, prosperity,
is going to be happiness or prosperity is for sure different from the way you, every single one of you, is going to define it. In this excerpt, we just went through too much about how the Islamic theology looks at happiness. The very highlighted part of this excerpt that just attracted my attention was the part in which talked about the people who would attain salvation, as the verses of the Holy Book of Quran says, they are satisfied with Allah, and Allah is satisfied with them. They love Him, and He loves them. So this is the utmost of happiness any Muslim could wish for. Like, I think this is the goal of our existence. This is the essence of all these drudgery that we're going through in this world. Actually, maybe I'm just exaggerating a bit, because, you know, life is a mixture of both. Like, you have happiness and you have sadness. So if we put this aside, this was just a side note to what I was just saying, I would say that the ultimate goal of our existence is to be a real obedient in a way that not only you would find prosperity and happiness in this world, but also you can have it as a reward in the hereafter. And how is the reward? The reward is manifested in this way that both the obedient and the Lord are satisfied with each other. Like, is there any more interesting and fascinating idea other than this, when you would feel the satisfaction with your own Lord? Honestly speaking, there is no one who could say there is, because this, as I just mentioned, this idea of satisfaction between the Lord and the obedient is the ultimate goal of our existence. And how is it achieved? How can we achieve this satisfaction? If I go and pop up this topic among my classmates or friends at university, maybe the replies I could get for happiness are more materialistic than what we think about. Like, what I mean by my friends, I mean like us as ordinary people. To us, happiness is something related to the amount of facilities we have, to the amount of travels I go to the amount of money I have, to the amount of literal happiness I could get in my life. How can I get those? According to me, as this real person in this real life, in this mundane, ordinary life, well, I just mentioned the ways. Like, to have everything as in the materialistic form, and having a fun, too much of fun. This is going to describe happiness to me. The happiness and the prosperity and the salvation that has been defined by the Holy Book of Quran and Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam is totally a different thing. The feeling of peace you might have in your life, that is the contentment you might have in your heart, and that is the satisfaction you would actually build in yourself and in the way you think about the relationship that you have with your own Lord. If you experience that peaceful moment in which you recognize how much satisfaction you have with your own Lord, and how strong is the link you two share with each other, then you would understand that there's nothing that could be compared to it. Like, if we think about this stuff more and more, and if we come to apply them in our lives, everything is going to be pretty much easier. If I understand that I'm not alone, and the one who's my Lord, the one who is the owner of the entire world, is by my side, and He's going to help me all the time, and He would never let me fall, or even if I fall, He's going to just hold me back. These are the things and ideas and feelings that are going to help me so much in developing myself more and more into a better version of myself, and also in going through all the difficulties that might occur in my life. So yeah, this was all. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Until another session, I just bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share he knows.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israel continues its bombing and shelling campaign in Gaza as a death toll for more than